In this, the new book, On My Way, there's a great essay called The Death of New England. The End of New England. That's what it is. All right, great. And I just got this like 2 days ago and already read it and already know that I'm going to be quoting from this for many years. And there's a couple of lines that I think that are important. And one of them is this, one is about the body being stupid. And I don't have that underlined, but, you know, talking about how that other school of poetry, that academic school, really has disdain for the body. And that's still going back to that Calvinist kind of Victorian era, you know, the body is dirty, especially the female body.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I think this is sort of like poets can easily align themselves with the desire for the poet to be dead. You know, because the dead poet is much more easily historicized and kind of, you know, kept. It's not a revolution, kids. It's something we study as a dead science, you know, and then we can see where the beats are and count the metrics and really not be disturbed by this stuff, but just sort of dissect it quietly and you know.
And control it?
Uh-huh. Good, yeah, yeah. And so it's sort of like, but Olson being the person who, you know, used the word proprioception, you know, in poetry. It's sort of like writing poetry with a sense that you're actually in a body enacting this poem in a real moment, you know, that live moment can never be gotten rid of even when the poet is dead. You know, it's very hard when I think about Ted's poems, for instance, or Alan's, to talk about this guy is not dead. You know, in that work, no. You know, and it's sort of like that's the problem and the glory of poetry, you know, and it's sort of like when you see poets start to take sides with the people who would prefer the poet to be dead, it might be helping them with their, quote, career right now, but it's not helping anybody else with anything else anywhere at all.
And in 200 years, people aren't going to read that work.
Well, when we see who people were reading at Whitman's, I mean, it was like some crazy sentimental, treacly poetry was being written in Whitman's moment. The best-selling poetry in America was, I don't know that it was it work by a woman? I hate to make that easy. It was like Miss Fanny's, you know, flower box or something. It was some insane sounding, you know, like ornate chocolate box of poetry, you know, and that was like the hit. You know, Whitman was this weird guy who was like, you know, writing fake reviews of himself by Emerson. I mean, it's also like this, I think even in our world, our poetry world, I think there's kind of a, people look down a little bit on self-promotion in a way, except like, please look through history at poets that we know and love, including Alan, and what genius they were at self-promotion. I feel like it's part of, you know, it's like part of a poet's duty is to make him or herself known, you know, and to figure out a new way to do that, you know.
And then the contribution of William Carlos Williams talking about using the American vernacular, right? Uh-huh. Right, like we talk.
Exactly.
There was a great instance of that in your in the last interview when you said it's like bringing around my Linus blanket. I mean, in 100 years, 200 years, there's going to be a little footnote saying
right.
Peanuts was a popular cartoon
right.
strip, you know, but right now we know what you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And you say on page 63 of On My Way in The End of New England, that essay, always we are guided towards the accent of the middle class, never to the blurred cadences of the workers,
uh-huh.
unless you want to be an actor.
Right. Yeah, and it's sort of like that whole kind of James Dean thing where all these bourgeois kids come to New York and suddenly they're like slouching in T-shirts and stuff and say, give me it, you know, and acting, you know, like, babe. You know, just kind of put on kind of like a little thug thing, but it's sort of like, it's sort of the Johnny Depp school of, you know, bourgeois. Well, actually, I don't know about Johnny Depp might be a working class guy, but it's sort of like, it's a thing to be lower class. It's like sexy. It's Brando. I mean, that's for guys. I mean, actually, it isn't really. Well, no, I think a girl can be trashy, be waitress-like. It's, you know, be a trashy girl. It's all very, you know, like hot. But it's like nobody wants to get caught in those classes.
Yeah, don't write poetry like that.
No, or look at somebody like Philip Levine, an example of the working class poet and the bourgeois academic. It's all content. It's the sentimentality of the worker, or poems about when he worked in a factory. He doesn't change his English. It's like, and it was like, then this is not a working class poem if it's not written in a jargon that drops because the body is there. We know the body is there. That's what the whole basis of working class speech is. The body is there. We can see the body, so we don't need to say everything. We don't need to speak in full sentences.
So, for example, something like duck, you know,
uh-huh.
you use that American vernacular to get someone's attention, and then you speak in quote-unquote normal sentences.
Exactly. And so it's that incredibly sexy shifting of attention all the time that we do. I mean, like in the essay I mentioned, it's sort of like if you're in bed with somebody, you could say, water, meaning, you know, pick up the, we've just been fucking for an hour, pick up the bottle of water off the floor and give it to me. And in a soft, tender, direct cadence that is not considered inexplicable or inarticulate. You know, it's sort of like what's illegible in one context is completely direct and even loving in another. And to be able to keep pulling the context around and closing the distance creates an intimacy. John Ashbery says this. I mean, he says the same thing that you know, it's like within these schools, there are many schools, and yet everybody's in a way saying the same thing, that it's sort of like you write the poem as if the person, as if the reader were in the same room with you. And so you don't need to talk about the blue. You don't always say that the wall is blue. We know it's blue. We're sitting in a blue room, you know? And so you talk about something else, you know?
So we go to one of the main distinctions between the open form poets, if we can call them that, and the academic poets. And that is that academic poetry, there's something inauthentic about it.
Well, they're still trying to get in the room. We are in the room. You know, and I try to talk like I'm in a society that knows it's in the room. And so that it's sort of like you start by being here now, you know, and you write from that place, you know, because where am I? Where I'm in the studio with you, Paul. There's no way that you and I would act like, you know, like we had. I mean, if we bothered to explain every little bit of technology that was making this conversation possible, we wouldn't even begin to have the conversation, you know.
Right. The center of any linguistic use is use and closing the distance is what you say. Yeah, that's what we're saying here. I mean, that's what it's about. It's about communicating. So getting hung up on grammar, you know, the people that like the grammar Nazis, and NPR fans are the biggest grammar Nazis, and they want to get in. And, you know, here you are as a, like me, a part-time jazz DJ. Totally improvising. I mean, there's certain things that are written for me, I have to say, but I'm improvising for 4 hours and they're listening at home. And, you know, they expect it to be like this thing, like I was a news reporter and I, you know, rehashed it 75 times and then put it out and had all the adverbs properly. Whereas, you know, I'm just vamping. I mean, give me a break, you know, but there's that thing that kind of that need to control when that obfuscates the effort to communicate.
Exactly. And that's the excitement of speech and the kind of poetics that we're talking about, is that it drops things and it gets there and it drops things and it gets there and it's live.
And with this kind of poetry, there's the possibility of prophecy.
Huh.
It opens the door wider, so the possibility that can come in. And I think a great example is Milk. So perhaps you can read that, and then we'll talk about it later. Talking with Eileen Miles, she'll be reading from Skies, her new book on Black Sparrow Press, one of her new releases. And she lives in New York City. And this, you know, after September 11th, we want to hear what New York City poets have to say about living in New York City. So we hear this poem called Milk.
I flew into New York and the season changed. A giant burr. Something hot was moving through the city that I knew so well. On the plane, though, it was white and stormy, faceless. I saw the sun and remembered the warning in the kitchen of all places, in which I was informed my wax would melt. No one had gone high around me. Where's the fear? I asked the sun. The birds are out there in their scattered sheep. The people in New York, like a tiny chain gang, are connected in their knowing and their saving one another. The morning trucks growl, oh, save me from knowing myself, if inside I only melt.
Yeah, the people of New York saving each other. How prophetic that is, or the attempt to do that. I mean, the firemen and the firemen being heroes, and NYPD and NYFD fire hats all over the country being the new chic. And you wrote that long before September 11th.
And I didn't, and it was always like, I always found the ending, though I liked the ending and I knew it was right, the save me from knowing myself if inside I only melt. I just didn't know what to do with that line. I thought, that's so disturbing. What do I mean? It sounds so depressing. I mean, I just felt like, you know, certainly I write sad and lonely lines all the time, but it was just like that one. I just went to some dirty place where I thought, where the hell is it? And now every time I read the poem, people go, oh. It's so weird, like the poem found its culture, you know?
Yeah, and that doesn't happen with the other school of poetry, does it?
Well, the thing is, I feel like if you're so busy constructing the present correctly, you never have time to get to the future, you know? Whereas if you're dropping things wildly because you're in a rush to be here, then you often run ahead of yourself, you know, and you're dropping little seeds, you know, that you won't be able to pick up for a year or two.
Yeah, and you say the poetry, the poem beats you down the street. What was your line? That's it, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's ahead. The poem is ahead of you, I think.
The poem is ahead of you. Yeah, right, exactly. Well, that's one thing, to write from that open sense that allows, I think, other entities or resonances to come through. That resonance of Ted Berrigan. He's alive, and somewhere the molecules that were his body kind of still are filtering around the earth somehow, you know, and there's that morphic resonance that we can tap into, especially you being close to him. So allowing other resonances or entities in the poem happens when you're more open, but yet that doesn't mean that you can't sit down and here's a poem about such and such, right? Here's, you know, you just break up with someone, you're depressed, you write a poem, you call it Harmonica, for instance. Mm-hmm. And if you have that handy, oh, here, you need to copy that. So this is from On My Way, Faux Press, one of the latest books of poetry and poetics, I guess you could say, from Eileen Miles. There's one essay on poetics called The End of New England.
I wrote Harmonica when I was it was in that sort of gap where it was sort of like one thing was deeply over and really, 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 really over, and something new was sort of about to happen, and it almost seemed like the only way to jump off into the pool of the new was to let the old become as completely dark and fizzled as it possibly could be. So I kind of, you know, there's a way in which you can't let yourself be as entirely sad as you are, unless you know that you're going to be, you can get out of that room, you know? And so it was sort of like, there's something so funny about this poem because it's such a sorrowful, bluesy poem, but it really was because I could see the light at the end of the tunnel and was going to be moving towards it. Harmonica. Don't want to put my glasses on because I don't want to see. Don't want to move again because I don't want to live. Don't want to love again because I don't want to lose. Don't want to eat again because I don't want to be full. Don't want to drink again because I don't want to feel quenched. Don't want to sleep again because I don't want to wake up. Don't want to live in the summer because I don't want to be hot. Don't want you to kiss me again because I don't want to be alive. Don't want to see you again because I don't want to vanish. Don't want to ride my bike because I don't want to get there. Don't want to know my family anymore because I don't want to remember me. Don't want to walk my dog because I don't want to be out. Don't want to stay in anymore because I don't want to be alone. Don't want to be tired anymore because I don't want to feel old. Don't want to eat candy anymore because I don't want to feel sweet. Don't want to talk to my friends anymore because I don't want them to know me. Don't want to sing anymore because I don't want to hear me. Don't want to die anymore because I don't want to see God. Don't want to live anymore because I don't want to repeat.
Was that a healing thing for you?
yeah, because I was just, it was kind of like, oh my God, I didn't, you know, this shame about certain feelings.
And about sort of, being rejected.
About not even wanting to exist. It's sort of like this, it's often it seems like to be a vital person, you have to want to be alive. And what about if you don't want to be alive at all? You feel like all the doors are closed, and as you knock on each one, there's nobody on the other side. And what do you do with that state? And you recoil, you know? And it was interesting to just walk right up to each door and knock and find it empty and knock and find it empty and knock and find it empty.
And, you know, you're writing that down, and your work with the younger literary troupe, Sister Spit, and you're now your role as the elder statesman in, uh-huh, in the lesbian poetry community, you know, that's going to give someone in 50 years, you know, someone 2 years, whatever, yeah, a sense that someone's been there before and made it through and became Eileen Miles, this wonderful professor of poetry at University of California, San Diego.
Next topic, right?
So well, we're out of time, unfortunately, because we could talk about a lot of things, but the fact that you've not only given that whole community a hope, but you've done it and not from a sense of what do they call this, quotas, this equal opportunity, you know, you've done it on the merits of your work, you know, you've done it as with all the rigor of a poet regardless of their sexual orientation. The work, you know, exists despite any categories we might put you in, and works on that way, and that's the way it should be.
Yay.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Paul. It's been great. It's been great being here.
Thank you so much. It's been one of my most wonderful experiences with the poet, and I hope there's some way we get you back into town in the near future.
Cool.
Eileen Miles has been our guest. She is the author of Skies, which is on Black Sparrow Press, and also On My Way on Faux Press.